You've been listening to Gilgamesh, a new English version by Stephen Mitchell, narrated by George Guidel and directed by Lynn Flanagan. Author Stephen Mitchell has written a comprehensive essay on the creation of this version of Gilgamesh. What follows is an essay by the author, narrated by John McDonough.
The oldest story in the world. In Iraq, when the dust blows, stopping men and tanks, it brings with it memories of an ancient world, much older than Islam or Christianity. Western civilization originated from that place between the Tigris and the Euphrates, where Hammurabi created his legal code, and where Gilgamesh was written. The oldest story in the world, 1,000 years older than the Iliad or the Bible. Its hero was a historical king who reigned in the Mesopotamian city of Uruk in about 2750 BCE. In the epic, he has an intimate friend, Enkidu, a naked wild man who has been civilized through the erotic arts of a temple priestess. With him, Gilgamesh battles monsters, and when Enkidu dies, he is inconsolable. He sets out on a desperate journey to find the one man who can tell him how to escape death. Part of the fascination of Gilgamesh is that, like any great work of literature, it has much to tell us about ourselves. In giving voice to grief and the fear of death, perhaps more powerfully than any book written after it, in portraying love and vulnerability and the quest for wisdom, it has become a personal testimony for millions of readers in dozens of languages. But it also has a particular relevance in today's world, with its polarized fundamentalisms, each side fervently believing in its own righteousness, each on a crusade or jihad against what it perceives as an evil enemy. The hero of this epic is an anti-hero, a superman, a superpower, one might say, who doesn't know the difference between strength and arrogance. By preemptively attacking a monster, he brings on himself a disaster that can only be overcome by an agonizing journey, a quest that results in wisdom by proving its own futility. The epic has an extraordinarily sophisticated moral intelligence. In its emphasis on balance, and in its refusal to side with either hero or monster, it leads us to question our dangerous certainties about good and evil. I began this version of Gilgamesh because I had never been convinced by the language of any translation of it that I'd read. I wanted to find a genuine voice for the poem, words that were lithe and muscular enough to match the power of the story. If I have succeeded, readers will discover that, rather than standing before an antiquity in a glass case, they have entered a literary masterpiece that is as startlingly alive today as it was 3.5 millennia ago. Origins. Gilgamesh is a work that, in the intensity of its imagination, stands beside the great stories of Homer and the Bible. Yet, for 2,000 years, all traces of it were lost. The baked clay tablets on which it was inscribed in cuneiform characters lay buried in the rubble of cities across the ancient Near East, waiting for people from another world to read them. It wasn't until 1853 that the first fragments were discovered among the ruins of Nineveh, and the text wasn't deciphered and translated for several decades afterward. The great poet Rainer Maria Rilke may have been the first reader discerning enough to recognize its true literary stature. "Gilgamesh is stupendous," he wrote at the end of 1916. "I consider it to be among the greatest things that can happen to a person. I have immersed myself in it, and in these truly gigantic fragments, I have experienced measures and forms that belong with the supreme works that the conjuring word has ever produced." In Rilke's consciousness, Gilgamesh, like a magnificent Aladdin's palace that has instantly materialized out of nowhere, makes its first appearance as a masterpiece of world literature. The story of its discovery and decipherment is itself as fabulous as a tale from the Thousand and One Nights. A young English traveller named Austin Henry Layard, who was passing through the Middle East on his way to Ceylon, heard that there were antiquities buried in the mounds of what is now the city of Mosul, halted his journey, and began excavations in 1844. These mounds turned out to contain the ruined palaces of Nineveh, the ancient capital of Assyria, including what was left of the library of the last great Assyrian king, Ashurbanipal, 668 to 627 BCE. In amazement, Layard and his assistant, Harmuzd Rassam, found room after room lined with carved stone bas-reliefs of demons and deities, scenes of battle, royal hunts and ceremonies, doorways flanked by enormous winged bulls and lions, and, inside some of the chambers, tens of thousands of clay tablets inscribed with the curious and then undeciphered cuneiform, wedge-shaped script. Over 25,000 of these tablets were shipped back to the British Museum. When cuneiform was officially deciphered in 1857, scholars discovered that the tablets were written in Akkadian, an ancient Semitic language cognate with Hebrew and Arabic. 15 years went by before anyone noticed the tablets on which Gilgamesh was inscribed. Then, in 1872, a young British Museum curator named George Smith realized that one of the fragments told the story of a Babylonian Noah who survived a great flood sent by the gods. "On looking down the third column," Smith wrote, "my eye caught the statement that the ship rested on the mountains of Nizir, followed by the account of the sending forth of the dove, and its finding no resting place and returning. I saw at once that I had here discovered a portion, at least, of the Chaldean account of the deluge." To a Victorian, this was a spectacular discovery, because it seemed to be independent corroboration of the historicity of the biblical flood. Victorians believed that the Genesis story was much older than it is. When Smith saw these lines, according to a later account, he said, "I am the first man to read that after more than 2,000 years of oblivion." Setting the tablet on the table, the account continues, "he jumped up and rushed about the room in a great state of excitement, and, to the astonishment of those present, began to undress himself." We aren't told if he took off just his coat, or if he continued to strip down further. I like to imagine him, in his euphoria, going all the way and running stark naked, like Enkidu, among the astonished black-clad Victorian scholars. Smith's announcement, made on December 3, 1872, to the newly formed Society of Biblical Archaeology, that he had discovered an account of the flood on one of the Assyrian tablets, caused a major stir, and soon more fragments of Gilgamesh were unearthed at Nineveh and in the ruins of other ancient cities. His translation of the fragments that had been discovered up to then was published in 1876. Though to a modern reader it seems quaint and almost surrealistic in its many mistaken guesses, and is often fragmentary to the point of incoherence, it was an important pioneering effort. Today, more than a century and a quarter later, many more fragments have surfaced, the language is much better understood, and scholars can trace the history of the text with some degree of confidence. Briefly, here is the consensus. Legends about Gilgamesh probably began to arise shortly after the death of the historical king. The earliest texts that have survived, which date from about 2100 BCE, are 5 separate and independent poems in Sumerian entitled Gilgamesh and Aga, Gilgamesh and Hawawa, Gilgamesh and the Bull of Heaven, Gilgamesh and the Underworld, and The Death of Gilgamesh. Sumerian is a non-Semitic language unrelated to any other that we know, and is as distant from Akkadian as Chinese is from English. It became the learned language of ancient Mesopotamia and was part of the scribal curriculum. These five poems, written in a leisurely, repetitive, hieratic style, much less condensed and vivid than the Akkadian epic, would have been familiar to later poets and editors. The direct ancestor of the 11 clay tablets dug up at Nineveh is called the Old Babylonian version. It was written in Akkadian, of which Babylonian is a dialect, and dates from about 1700 BCE. 11 fragments have survived, including 3 tablets that are almost complete. This version, though it paraphrases a few episodes in the Sumerian Gilgamesh texts, is an original poem, the first epic of Gilgamesh. In its themes and its form, it is essentially the same poem as its Ninevite descendant, a story about friendship, the death of the beloved, and the quest for immortality. Some 500 years after the Old Babylonian version was written, a scholar-priest named Sinleike Unini revised and elaborated on it. His epic, which scholars call the Standard Version, is the basis for all modern translations. As of now, with 73 fragments discovered, slightly fewer than 2,000 of the 3,000 lines of the original text exist in readable, continuous form. The rest is damaged or missing, and there are many gaps in the sections that have survived. We don't know exactly what Sinleike Unini's contribution to the Standard Version was, since so few fragments of the Old Babylonian version have survived for comparison. From what we can see, he is often a conservative editor, following the older version line for line, with few, if any, changes in vocabulary and word order. Sometimes, though, he expands or contracts, drops passages or adds them, and functions not as an editor but as an original poet. The two major passages that we know he added, the prologue and the priestess Shamhat's speech, inviting Enkidu to Uruk, have the vividness and density of great art. The Gilgamesh that you are about to read is a sometimes free, sometimes close adaptation into English verse of Sinleike Unini's Standard Version. Even scholars making literal translations don't simply translate the Standard Version. They fill in some of the textual gaps with passages from other versions, the Old Babylonian being the most important. I have taken this practice further. Occasionally, when the Standard Version is particularly fragmentary, I have supplemented it with passages from the Sumerian Gilgamesh poems. I have also added lines or short passages to bridge the gaps or to clarify the story. My intention throughout has been to recreate the ancient epic as a contemporary poem in the parallel universe of the English language. Civilizing the Wild Man. Gilgamesh is the story of a hero's journey. One might say that it is the mother of all heroes' journeys, with its huge, uninhibited, mythic presences moving through a landscape of dream. It is also the story of how a man becomes civilized, how he learns to rule himself, and therefore his people, and to act with temperance, wisdom, and piety. The poem begins with the city and ends with it. In the first lines of his prologue, Sinleike Unini states the breadth and depth of what his hero had endured. He had seen everything, had experienced all emotions. The next 7 lines tell us the essential details, not even bothering to mention the hero's name. Gilgamesh had traveled to the edge of the world and been granted knowledge of the primeval days of humanity. He had survived the journey and returned to restore the great temple of Ishtar and Uruk's then-famous 6-mile-long wall. And now, after this summary, something fascinating happens. Sinleike Unini turns to his readers and invites them to survey the great city for themselves. See how its ramparts gleam like copper in the sun. Climb the stone staircase, more ancient than the mind can imagine. Approach the Eanna Temple, sacred to Ishtar, a temple that no king has equaled in size or beauty. Walk on the wall of Uruk, follow its course around the city, inspect its mighty foundations, examine its brickwork, how masterfully it is built. Observe the land it encloses, the palm trees, the gardens, the orchards, the glorious palaces and temples, the shops and marketplaces, the houses, the public squares. It is a very strange and touching moment. The poet is ostensibly addressing an audience of ancient Babylonians in 1200 BCE, directing them to admire a city that was built in time immemorial. But the readers, as it turns out, are you and I. We are the ones who are being invited, more than 3,000 years later, to walk on the wall of Uruk and observe the splendor and bustling life of the great city. The invitation is touching, not because the city is in ruins and the civilization has been destroyed. This is not an ironic Ozymandias moment, but because in our imagination we can climb the ancient stone staircase and observe the lush gardens and orchards, the palaces and temples, the shops and marketplaces, the houses, the public squares, and share the poet's amazement and pride in his city. Then Sinleika Unini's invitation becomes more intimate. Find the cornerstone, he tells us, and under it the copper box that is marked with his name. Unlock it. Open the lid. Take out the tablet of lapis lazuli. Read how Gilgamesh suffered all and accomplished all. I doubt whether even in 1200 BCE this was meant to be taken literally. Even to an ancient Babylonian reader, the lines would have been vivid enough to make the physical act unnecessary. As we read the instructions, we can see ourselves finding the cornerstone, taking out the copper box, unlocking it, opening its lid, and taking out the priceless tablet of lapis lazuli, which turns out in the end to be the very poem we are about to read. We are looking beneath the surface of things, into the hidden places, the locked repositories of human experience. The trials that Gilgamesh himself is supposed to have written down long ago are now being revealed to us in words that, whether carved on stone tablets or printed on paper, create their own sense of authenticity. They issue directly from the source, if not from the historical Gilgamesh, then from a poet who has imagined that hero's experience intensely enough for it to be true. The old Babylonian poem that Sinleika Unini inherited begins with the phrase, "surpassing all kings." It describes Gilgamesh as a gigantic and manic young man. His name may mean the old man is a young man, a warrior, and after his return as a good king and benefactor to his people, a combination of Goliath and David. But to begin with, he is a tyrant. When we first enter the poem, there is an essential imbalance in the city. Something has gone drastically wrong. The man of unsurpassable courage and inexhaustible energy has become a monster of selfishness. The shepherd has become a wolf. He oppresses the young men, perhaps with forced labor, and oppresses the young women, perhaps with his ravenous sexual appetite. Because he is an absolute monarch, and two-thirds divine into the bargain, no one dares to criticize him. The people call out to heaven, like the Israelite slaves in Exodus, and their cry is heard. But Anu, father of the gods, doesn't intervene directly. He sends help in a deliciously roundabout way. He asks the great mother goddess Aruru to reenact her first creation of human beings. Now go and create a double for Gilgamesh, his second self, a man who equals his strength and courage, a man who equals his stormy heart. Create a new hero. Let them balance each other perfectly, so that Uruk has peace. Like the Lord God in Genesis, Aruru forms a man from the dust of the ground, and he becomes a living being, the original man himself, natural, innocent, solitary. This second Adam will find a helpmeet for him, not in a woman, but in the man for whose sake he was created. Thus begins, 1,000 years before Achilles and Patroclus, or David and Jonathan, the first great friendship in literature. Enkidu is indeed Gilgamesh's double, so huge and powerful that when people see him they are struck with awe. But he is also Gilgamesh's opposite and mirror image, two-thirds animal to Gilgamesh's two-thirds divine. These animal qualities are actually much more attractive than the divine ones. Where Gilgamesh is arrogant, Enkidu is childlike. Where Gilgamesh is violent, Enkidu is peaceful, a naked herbivore among the herds. He lives and wanders with them from pasture to pasture, and, as we learn later in the poem, he drives away marauding predators, thus acting as both sheep and shepherd. With his natural altruism, he is also the original animal activist, setting his friends free from human pits and traps. When the trapper discovers Enkidu drinking with the animals at a waterhole, he is filled with dread, as if he has seen a Bigfoot or abominable snowman. What makes his face go white and his legs shake is not the fear of being harmed by a powerful savage. After all, he doesn't have to get any closer. It is the fear of being face to face with primordial humanity, the thing itself. He goes to his father for advice, and the father sends him on to Gilgamesh, who will know what to do. Gilgamesh may be a tyrant, but he is an insightful one. He does know what to do about the wild man, and he tells it to the trapper without a moment's hesitation. "Go to the temple of Ishtar," he says. "Ask them there for a woman named Shamhat, one of the priestesses who give their bodies to any man in honor of the goddess. Take her into the wilderness. When the animals are drinking at the waterhole, tell her to strip off her robe and lie there naked, ready, with her legs apart. The wild man will approach. Let her use her love arts. Nature will take its course, and then the animals who knew him in the wilderness will be bewildered and will leave him forever." It is a startling recommendation, especially coming from a man whose modus operandi is force. We might have expected him to send out a battalion to hunt down and capture Enkidu. Instead, he commissions a single woman. Somehow he knows that Enkidu needs to be tamed rather than captured, and that the only way to civilize him is through the power of Eros. He doesn't seem to suspect, however, that the wild man has been sent by the gods to civilize him. The poem says nothing about Gilgamesh's relationship to Shamhat. Does he know how skilled she is because he has made love with her himself at the temple? Is he a regular client? Or has he just heard of her prowess? All we are told is that he knows she is the right woman for the job. Shamhat is one of the most fascinating characters in Gilgamesh. If we want to appreciate her role as an ancient Babylonian cultic prostitute, our imagination needs to bypass any filters of romantic love, Judeo-Christian morality, male lubricity, or female indignation. Actually, we have no word in English for what Shamhat is. The Akkadian words Harimtu and Samhatu certainly do not mean prostitute in our sense of the term, a woman who sells herself for personal gain. She is a priestess of Ishtar, the goddess of love, and as a kind of reverse nun has dedicated her life to what the Babylonians considered the sacred mystery of sexual union. In opening to the anonymous man who appears before her in the temple, young or old, handsome or ugly, she is opening to every man, that is, to God. She has become an incarnation of the goddess, and with her own body reenacts the cosmic marriage. As a pure servant of Eros, she is a vessel for the force that moves the stars, the force that, through the green fuse, drives the flower. In a passage about the attractions of Uruk that was added in the Standard Version, Sinleika Unini mentions Ishtar's priestesses with enormous pride. "Come," said Shamhat, "let us go to Uruk. I will lead you to Gilgamesh, the mighty king. You will see the great city with its massive wall. You will see the young men dressed in their splendor, in the finest linen and embroidered wool, brilliantly colored, with fringed shawls and wide belts. Every day is a festival in Uruk, with people singing and dancing in the streets, musicians playing their lyres and drums, the lovely priestesses standing before the temple of Ishtar, chatting and laughing, flushed with sexual joy, and ready to serve men's pleasure in honor of the goddess, so that even old men are aroused from their beds." How the poet loves his city! The great wall, the colors, the finery, the music and dancing, they all form the texture of the continuous celebration of life that makes this passage so alive. Part of the enjoyment he conveys is that in Uruk, male sexual desire is so abundantly gratified. But it is the lovely, joyful priestesses, themselves gratified in the act of gratification, who light up his portrait of the city. Their laughter and sexual glow is, for him, one of the principal glories of civilization. The trapper finds Shamhat and tells her of the king's command. Shamhat has been trained in the art of surrender, and I imagine her as giving her full consent to the mission, dangerous though it might be. The creature she will be offering herself to is, after all, an unknown. He may be ferocious, he may be more beast than man, he may even tear her to shreds, for all she knows, and she probably knows that the very sight of him filled the trapper with dread. But she agrees to go, calmly, as I imagine her, trusting in her art and in the power of Eros. The waterhole is a 3 days' hike through the wilderness, and the poet could easily have inserted dialogues here between the young priestess of Ishtar and the trapper. What was she feeling on the long and perhaps physically taxing walk? Was she afraid? What did she ask him about his life, about Enkidu? Was he dazzled by her sexual presence? Was he tempted? Did they make love, or was that forbidden? What did he ask her, and what did she answer, about the life of the city, about her experiences in the temple, about Gilgamesh the king? The poet compresses all the dramatic possibilities of these 3 days into 2 lines. For 3 days they walked. On the 3rd day they reached the water hole. There they waited. The economy of his art is exquisite. For another 2 days, Shamhat and the trapper wait at the waterhole. When Enkidu appears, Shamhat follows directions, not that a skilled priestess of Ishtar would have needed directions, and events unfold just as Gilgamesh predicted they would. It is a deeply moving episode, especially if we have in the back of our minds the Genesis myth of the loss of human innocence. Here, Shamhat plays the role of Eve, but she is a benign seductress, leading Enkidu not into the knowledge of a polarized good and evil, but into the glories of sexuality, the intimate understanding of what a woman is, and self-awareness as a human being. There is no serpent in this garden, no anxious deity announcing prohibitions and punishments. Again, the poet's economy is superb. The 7 days of lovemaking are described in the simplest of terms. Compressed into 7 lines is a whole epic of sexual initiation. Enkidu, in his innocence and trust, follows where his penis points, and discovers in himself an elemental potency, a state of perpetual erection. For Shamhat's part, however frightened she may be as the enormous hairy creature approaches, she takes him in lovingly and keeps taking him in for 7 days, a feat that is at least equal to any of the showier male heroics later in the poem. She used her love arts, she took his breath with her kisses, held nothing back, and showed him what a woman is. For 7 days he stayed erect and made love with her. There are no traces of Puritan consciousness in the culture of this poem. Sex is seen as a civilizing event rather than as something dangerous to the social order. One would be interested to know precisely what the love arts of a Babylonian priestess were, but this also the poet leaves to the imagination. Whatever the graphic details, Shamhat obviously does her job well. Adept and lavishly generous, she totally justifies Gilgamesh's confidence in her. At the end of 7 days, when he has had enough of the non-stop lovemaking, Enkidu tries to rejoin his animals, but they dart away at full speed, like the fawn that emerges with Alice from the wood where things have no names. Enkidu no longer has the unconscious mind of an animal, or the vital force he had as a child of the wilderness. Something has been lost, but it is not paradise. In fact, Enkidu is about to enter another kind of paradise, civilization, the city where every day is a festival. Walking back to Shamhat, he realizes that although he can no longer run like an animal, he has gained something that more than makes up for his lost powers. In knowing Shamhat sexually, his mind has been enlarged. He has begun to know himself. He sits down at her feet, and as he listens, he discovers that he can understand human language. He also discovers for himself what the Lord God realizes for Adam in Genesis, that it is not good that the man should be alone. In this longing for a true friend, he intuits what he was created for. Shamhat not only initiates Enkidu into self-awareness between her civilizing thighs, she invites him to Uruk, gives him human clothing, and teaches him to eat human food in the hut of some shepherds who live conveniently nearby. She acts as a patient, loving mother as she guides him through this rite of passage. The scene at the shepherd's table is both hilarious and touching, with its shame-free awareness that initiation into humanity means knowing what it is to be sexual, intoxicated, and clean. They led him to their table. They put bread and beer in front of him. Enkidu sat and stared. He had never seen human food. He didn't know what to do. Then Shamhat said, "Go ahead, Enkidu. This is food. We humans eat and drink this." Warily he tasted the bread. Then he ate a piece. He ate a whole loaf. Then ate another. He ate until he was full, drank 7 pitchers of the beer. His heart grew light. His face glowed, and he sang out with joy. He had his hair cut, he washed, he rubbed sweet oil into his skin, and became fully human. We get 3 further glimpses of Shamhat, as she and Enkidu make love yet again, as she humbly carries out a request of his, and finally, as she accompanies him to Uruk. Then, having completed her mission, she is gone. The challenge. Great walled Uruk, city of gardens and temples and public squares, is the paradise of Shamhat's description. But it is also a place of suffering, where the people cry out because of Gilgamesh's tyranny. The 2 realities coexist. They appear according to one's perception, the way light is either particle or wave. It all depends on how one approaches the city. When she invites Enkidu to Uruk, Shamhat suggests that he approach with the eyes of appreciation, that he stand before Gilgamesh and gaze with wonder at his magnificence. But Enkidu isn't ready for this. He needs to approach him as a tyrant and an adversary. Shamhat did, in fact, introduce Gilgamesh as a tyrant the first time she mentioned him, without a hint of the panegyric that is to follow. "Let me take you to great-walled Uruk, to the temple of Ishtar, to the palace of Gilgamesh, the mighty king, who, in his arrogance, oppresses the people, trampling upon them like a wild bull." Enkidu's response is surprising. He doesn't bristle or become white with anger, as he does later when he hears of Gilgamesh's apparent right to sleep with any about-to-be-married virgin. He intuits something in Gilgamesh beyond his brute strength and callousness. His longing is a recognition that floats up toward the surface of his consciousness, a recognition before the fact that however unjust Gilgamesh may be, they are meant for each other. Deep in his heart, he felt something stir, a longing he had never known before, the longing for a true friend. But immediately he shifts from this poignant, introspective silence to an aggressive stance that matches Gilgamesh in arrogance. "I will challenge him," Enkidu says. "I will shout to his face, 'I am the mightiest. I am the man who can make the world tremble. I am supreme.'" If a strong young gorilla had the power of speech, this is what he might cry out to the alpha male with his harem of wives. The challenge is touching in its primitiveness. There is no Homeric subtlety or eloquence here, just testosterone speaking. "Another hero? I will fight him." Enkidu needs to test himself to enter civilization with a chip on his shoulder the size of a cedar trunk. Shamhat, speaking as his teacher, suggests that he approach Gilgamesh from a different perspective. "I will show you Gilgamesh, the mighty king, the hero destined for both joy and grief. You will stand before him and gaze with wonder. You will see how handsome, how virile he is, how his body pulses with erotic power. He is even taller and stronger than you, so full of life force that he needs no sleep. Enkidu, put aside your aggression." But Enkidu is having none of it. Nothing can bring him out of his male challenge mode. The specific impetus for the trip to Uruk comes from the mouth of a young man who passes Enkidu and Shamhat, as they are making love again, on his way to Uruk for a wedding that he has catered. Enkidu's curiosity is aroused more highly than his passion. He interrupts the coitus and sends Shamhat over to make inquiries. The young man describes what will happen at the end of the ceremony. "The priest will bless the young couple, the guests will rejoice, the bridegroom will step aside, and the virgin will wait in the marriage bed for Gilgamesh, king of great-walled Uruk. It is he who mates first with the lawful wife. After he is done, the bridegroom follows. This is the order that the gods have decreed. From the moment the king's birth cord was cut, every girl's hymen has belonged to him." As he listened, we are told, Enkidu's face went pale with anger. But we aren't told why he is angry. Is this the indiscriminate fury of a young challenger? Is he feeling moral outrage at Gilgamesh's jus primae noctis? If so, hasn't he understood that this is a ritual act sanctioned by the gods? Is the act sanctioned by the gods, as the young man says, or is this statement propaganda, issuing from a sexually predatory tyrant? We know that the gods have sent Enkidu to balance Gilgamesh's oppression, but we don't know the precise nature of that oppression. It is entirely possible that Gilgamesh, as the embodiment of the divine male principle, does have the right to sleep with every bride on her wedding night, but that he is appropriating other young women as well. It is also possible, as some scholars think, that the oppression has nothing sexual about it, that Gilgamesh, as a gigantic super-jock, has been exhausting the men in athletic contests, and the women are worn out from taking care of them. Finally, if the young man's report is accurate, and if Enkidu has understood it correctly, is he rebelling against the divine order? Or, alternatively, does he accept the divine order and simply want to replace Gilgamesh as the stud planting his seed in the virgins of Uruk? We simply don't know. This not knowing is an interesting position to be in as a reader. It will become even more interesting in the monster-slaying episode of books 3 through 5. One thing it means is that we don't take sides. Yes, Gilgamesh is a tyrant, but he is also magnificent. Yes, he mates with the lawful wife, but this apparent sexual predation may be in the divine order of things, and to oppose it is not necessarily virtuous. Every negative about him is balanced by a positive. Of course, from another perspective, it is clear that the whole world of Uruk is out of balance because of Gilgamesh's manic excesses, and that Enkidu has been created to restore that balance. It is equally clear that the confrontation between the two heroes is not going to be a struggle between good and evil. There are too many ambiguities here for the mind to settle in a position of moral certainty. This leaves us with the raw emotion of Enkidu's anger, which, unexplained and uninterpretable, serves to move him from the shepherd's huts to the great city. As Enkidu enters Uruk, he is mobbed like a celebrity. He may be gigantic, he may have a savage past, but he is fully human now, and recognizing his innocence, people are not too frightened to approach him, as the trapper was. The crowds treat him with a mixture of awe and tenderness, marveling at his enormous body and kissing his enormous feet as if they were doting mothers kissing the most luscious morsels of infant flesh. Enkidu finds his way to the marriage house and plants himself in front of the door, immovable. When Gilgamesh arrives, the two heroes seize each other, butting heads like wild bulls, careening through the streets, crashing into walls, and making the houses tremble. The confrontation could hardly be more primal, stripped down to the element of male pride. Enkidu's anger is beside the point. There are no principles to be upheld, no justifications and counter-justifications. The battle is as silly as a schoolyard fight, yet there is something beautiful about its energy. There is also a deeply erotic element in it. This is not a fight to the death, as in the Iliad or Beowulf. It is a fight at the end of which each man will be able to say to his opponent, "Now I know you." Or even, as Jacob said to his angel, "I will not let thee go, except thou bless me." It is an entrance into intimacy, and as close to lovemaking as to violence. The poem comes just short of stating that the relationship between Gilgamesh and Enkidu is homosexual. In Tablet 12, a separate poem appended to the epic, the genital sexuality is explicit. But it's clear that the homoerotic element in their bond is very strong. Even before he meets Enkidu in combat, Gilgamesh dreams of him in an image of great physical tenderness. A boulder, representing Enkidu, falls from the sky. At first it is too heavy to budge, then it becomes the beloved in his arms, stone turning to warm flesh through the power of the metaphor. Gilgamesh's mother, in interpreting the dream, says that that is indeed how it will be, that the boulder stands for a dear friend, a mighty hero. You will take him in your arms, embrace and caress him, the way a man caresses his wife. Both men come to feel their friendship as a kind of marriage, and each one could say, as David says of Jonathan, "Thy love to me is wonderful, surpassing the love of women. After the fight, Enkidu doesn't slink off or proffer his neck like an animal defeated by the alpha male. In a speech of the loveliest, most dignified humility, he acknowledges Gilgamesh as the superior fighter, the superior human being. In fact, he sees him with the eyes of appreciation, gazing at him in wonder as Shamhat had advised him to. Gilgamesh, you are unique among humans. Your mother, the goddess Ninsun, made you stronger and braver than any mortal, and rightly has Enlil granted you the kingship, since you are destined to rule over men. Gilgamesh, as victor, doesn't feel the need to reciprocate with any appreciation of Enkidu, but he knows that what he dreamed at the end of Book One has come true. The dear friend and mighty hero has appeared, the longed-for companion of his heart, the man who will stand at his side through the greatest dangers. The fight is over without any residue of anger, resentment, or competitiveness. They know each other through and through. Like David and Jonathan, each loves the other as his own soul. A Monster in the House. So Gilgamesh and Enkidu become true friends. Now, because the two heroes balance each other perfectly, Uruk can have peace. Now the son can return to his father, the girl can return to her mother, and the life of the great city can continue in all its vibrancy with no shadow of oppression to make the people cry out. The two realities can collapse into Shamhat's enamored vision of a truly civilized, festive society of bright colors and finery and music and laughing courtesan priestesses and gratified desire. The gods are in their heaven, and, for the time being, all's right with the world. The transition to the next episode, the journey to the cedar forest, and the killing of the monster Humbaba, is fragmentary and obscure. We aren't told how long Gilgamesh and Enkidu stayed in Uruk, deepening their friendship. We don't know what they did during those weeks or months. How do vigorous young giants spend their free time? This is not one of the poem's interests, but it's easy to imagine an ongoing revel of feasting and beer drinking, wrestling matches, swimming, polo, bullfighting, perhaps. Gilgamesh delightedly teaching his friend all the new dances and songs, daily visits to the Eanna temple to make love with the most beautiful of the young priestesses, Shamhat included, and, because ancient Babylonian kings prided themselves on being scholars as well as warriors and athletes, daily visits to the royal library, where Enkidu can take lessons in elementary cuneiform. At a certain point, though, out of the blue, Gilgamesh announces that it is time to leave Uruk and begin the fatal adventure that provides the shape for the rest of the epic, an ascent to an ambiguous victory, followed by a plunge into death, unassuageable grief, and the futile search for immortality. "Now we must travel to the cedar forest," Gilgamesh says, "where the fierce monster Humbaba lives. We must kill him and drive out evil from the world." Living in the year 2004, one can't help hearing this statement of an ancient Mesopotamian king in eerie counterpoint to the recent American invasion of Iraq. From this perspective, Gilgamesh's action is the original preemptive attack. Ancient readers, like many contemporary Americans, would have considered it to be unquestionably heroic. But the poem is wiser than the culture from which it arose. It wonderfully complicates the ostensible moral certainties, and once again, when we look closely, the mind finds no solid ground to stand on. What impels Gilgamesh to go on this adventure? Why should he kill the monster? At first, all we hear is the sudden announcement itself. As listeners to a great adventure story, we don't need any more motivation than this. After all, that's what heroes do. They slay monsters. The motivation in this sense is literary rather than psychological. Story, not character, is fate. But a bit further on, the poet does provide a motivation for the decision to leave for the Cedar Forest. What Gilgamesh wants is fame, as he explains in a passionate speech to Enkidu. "We are not gods. We cannot ascend to heaven. No, we are mortal men. Only the gods live forever. Our days are few in number, and whatever we achieve is a puff of wind. Why be afraid, then, since sooner or later death must come? I will cut down the tree. I will kill Humbaba. I will make a lasting name for myself. I will stamp my fame on men's minds forever." It is obvious that Gilgamesh considers himself fully human, and that for him, two-thirds divine is just a polite compliment or a rhetorical flourish. His mother may be a goddess, but he is as mortal as any other human. The only way for him to transcend death, he thinks, is to make an everlasting name for himself. The desire for fame is at the heart of the ancient heroic traditions, Babylonian, Greek, and Germanic. It is one of the nobler delusions, and it can produce great art, in addition, as we know, to great havoc. There is something very human and even endearing about all this posturing. Human nature hasn't changed much from Gilgamesh or Enkidu with his "I am the mightiest" to Cassius Clay. But heroic? It's hard to take the boasts and the derring do seriously in comparison with the actions of what we would all consider true heroes, those who risk harm or death for the sake of others. The anonymous, everyday heroism of firefighters and police officers makes the desire for a lasting name seem far less admirable to us than it has seemed to other cultures. In any event, the poet makes it clear from the outset that however morally Gilgamesh thinks he is acting, he wants to kill Humbaba and drive out evil from the world, not for the sake of the people, or to alleviate suffering, or to help anyone but himself. As the story proceeds, we hear another possible motivation that Shamash, the sun god, god of justice, and Gilgamesh's special protector, has put this decision into his head. At least, that is the theory of Gilgamesh's mother, the goddess Ninsun. Neither Gilgamesh nor Shamash ever acknowledges it. According to her, the whole adventure is Shamash's idea, and Gilgamesh is only an instrument in his hand, a warrior in the battle of good against evil. "Lord of heaven," Ninsun says in her prayer to the sun god, "you have granted my son beauty and strength and courage. Why have you burdened him with a restless heart? Now you have stirred him up to attack the monster Humbaba, to make a long journey from which he may not return. Since he has resolved to go, protect him until he arrives at the Cedar Forest, until he kills the monster Humbaba and drives from the world the evil that you hate." Here Ninsun, the wise, the all-knowing, is portrayed as a purely human figure, neither more nor less wise than any worried mother of flesh and blood. She knows her son well, and when she mentions his restless heart, she is pointing to what drives Gilgamesh throughout the epic, both before and after Enkidu's death. Whatever Shamash's part in the process may be, we can understand how Gilgamesh's restless heart has stirred him up, as powerfully as his desire for fame. Psychologically, this restlessness can't be inspired by the god of justice. It is the opposite of inspiration. It is ultimately desperation. One might even say that the attack on Humbaba stems from what Pascal called the cause of all human misery, the inability to sit contentedly alone in a room. Is Ninsun correct in her theory that this is a battle of good against evil? Everything in the poem argues against it. As a matter of fact, the only evil we are informed of is the suffering Gilgamesh has inflicted on his own people. The only monster is Gilgamesh himself. If he has a real enemy, it is the selfishness that arises from his own restless heart. Uruk may be at peace now, but Gilgamesh isn't. The moral imbalance still exists. He is, as far as we are told, unable to acknowledge what he has done, unable to apologize or make amends to the young men and women he has been terrorizing. Whatever Gilgamesh's mother may say, the poet makes it impossible to see Humbaba as a threat to the security of Uruk, or as part of any axis of evil. Unlike Grendel in Beowulf, he is not seen as the enemy of God. There is no devil or negative metaphysical force in the poet's cosmology for him to be an instrument of. He hasn't harmed a single living being, as far as we know. If anything, our sympathies are with him. He may be ugly and terrifying, with his fire-spewing breath, thunderous voice, and nightmare faces, but to be terrifying is his job. He just stays where he is, minding his business and doing his duty, which is to take care of the cedar forest and keep humans out. "If anyone knows the rules of my forest," he says later to Enkidu, "it is you. You know that this is my place, and that I am the forest's guardian. Enlil put me here to terrify men, and I guard the forest as Enlil ordains." Like the pre-civilized Enkidu, Humbaba is a figure of balance and a defender of the ecosystem. Having a monster or two around to guard our national forests from corporate and other predators wouldn't be such a bad thing. I love how the poet has morally situated his poem so that as soon as we are tempted to take a position about good and evil, we realize that there is an opposite and equally valid position. This world, like ours, is not black and white. There is ultimately nowhere to stand, no side we can ultimately take and not cut ourselves off from the truth. Yes, Humbaba is a monster. Perhaps he is evil, as Ninsun says. Conceivably, he is even a threat to the city, though we are never told how. But it is at least as true that Humbaba has his appointed place in the divine order of things. He has specifically been commissioned to be monstrous by one of the great gods, because humans are not supposed to penetrate into the cedar forest and chop down its trees. If there must be a monster in the house, to paraphrase Wallace Stevens, let him be one who is just doing his job without malice. The problem with believing in evil monsters and an evil-hating god with a small or capital G is that it splits the universe down the middle, separates us from at least half of creation, and eventually leads to the claustrophobic and doom-haunted world of the Germanic hero sagas, however idealistic we may be. The struggle between good and evil is the primal disease of the mind, wrote the 6th-century Zen master Sung Tsong, who knew what he was talking about. It is all too easy to see ourselves as fighting on God's side, to identify our ideology with what is best for the world, and use it to justify crusades, pogroms, or preemptive attacks. Projecting evil onto the world makes me unassailably right. A position as dangerous in politics as in marriage. Much of Book Three is in debate form, between Gilgamesh and Enkidu, then between Gilgamesh and the elders of Uruk. It is a debate between bravery, or foolhardiness, and prudence. Gilgamesh's position is that he must go on this journey in order to win everlasting fame. Enkidu first points out that the cedar forest is forbidden to humans, and that Humbaba has been put there by Enlil himself to terrify men. Then, echoed by the elders, he says that in any case the journey is too dangerous and Humbaba too powerful. The arguments are not sophisticated and don't vary. Gilgamesh wins the debate by walking away. He is the king, after all, and can do whatever he wants. What he wants now is to order new weapons at the forge. By the end of the episode, Enkidu and the whole city support him. The elders offer their cautious, geriatric advice. The young men cheer. The heroes depart. They walk east in 3-day marches at the pace of more than 300 miles a day. Not a huge effort for someone like Gilgamesh, whose legs, according to one fragmentary passage, are 9 feet tall. Each march is described in exactly the same way. The repetition creates a sense of extended time, a shift from the ordinary time of the city into mythological time. Each culminates in the dream ritual, which is described in the same few crisply visualized lines. Gilgamesh's dreams vary in their details, but they are all essentially the same dream of disaster or near disaster. Enkidu, by the method known as reversal of values, interprets them as omens that promise victory. And though his interpretation is correct for the actual battle with Humbaba, there is another sense in which the dreams are begging to be taken at their face value, unreversed, as the other dreams in the epic are. A disaster does indeed loom ahead, though with a time delay. Ironically, it involves the death of the dream interpreter, a death that is the direct, divinely ordained consequence of killing Humbaba. A more literal interpreter might advise Gilgamesh to turn back, however aggressively Shamash urges him to attack. Inside the cedar forest, Gilgamesh and Enkidu are alternately seized by terror, and each in turn encourages the other. For a Babylonian hero, unlike the imperviously brave men of Germanic legends, like Beowulf and Siegfried, it was no disgrace to feel fear. Gilgamesh can not only be afraid at the sight of the monster, but can say he is. He does not run like the great Hector, fleeing in terror from Achilles outside the wall of Troy, but he is frozen in his tracks. Enkidu, who previously was so reluctant to proceed, now urges Gilgamesh not to retreat, and they walk on to the monster's den. The battle is over quickly. Humbaba is about to overwhelm the two heroes when Shamash sends mighty winds that pin him down and paralyze him. This divine intervention may strike us as rather unfair, but a world in which the gods take sides is not a meritocracy. With Gilgamesh on top of him, holding a knife to his throat, Humbaba begs both heroes for mercy. These passages are at once comic and poignant. Comic in the disproportion between the monster's previous threats and his present abasement, and poignant in the humility and reasonableness of his request. It is an extraordinary moment. Think how impossible it would be in Beowulf for a monster to refer to the concept of mercy, or for the hero even to consider it. One can't help feeling a surge of sympathy for the doomed Humbaba. Gilgamesh hesitates. We are not told why, but it is probable that, like his predecessor in the Sumerian poem Gilgamesh and Hawawa, Gilgamesh's noble heart took pity on the monster. Enkidu, though, has no doubts. 3 separate times he urges his friend to kill the guardian of the cedar forest, even though he is aware that killing him will enrage not only Enlil, but their own protector Shamash as well. Thus, as it turns out, Ninsun, the wise, the all-knowing, was mistaken in her opinion that Humbaba is an evil thing that Shamash wants to have destroyed. Defeated, yes. Destroyed, no. Dear friend, quickly, before another moment goes by, kill Humbaba. Don't listen to his words. Don't hesitate. Slaughter him. Slit his throat. Before the great god Enlil can stop us. Before the great gods can get enraged. Enlil in Nippur. Shamash in Larsa. Establish your fame, so that forever men will speak of brave Gilgamesh, who killed Humbaba in the cedar forest. Enkidu, it seems, has by now completely taken on Gilgamesh's warrior ethos, the desire for fame superseding every other consideration. True, It is his friend's fame, not his own, that he wants to establish. But generous as it may be, this love is still an égoïsme à deux. It has simply replaced I am the mightiest with you are the mightiest. And in its disregard for mercy, prudence, and cosmic hierarchy, it creates disaster. The principle that every action has an effect is not something that Gilgamesh or Enkidu can be expected to know. As heroes, they need to be strong and brave, not insightful. But the poet, as we will see, is aware of it. He is too intelligent not to know that monster-slaying expeditions, even the most well-intentioned ones, have unforeseen and potentially disastrous consequences. Enkidu is morally responsible for persuading his friend not to spare the monster's life. Therefore, his own life becomes forfeit. When Gilgamesh kills Humbaba, the poet says, "A gentle rain falls onto the mountains, as if the heavens themselves are weeping for the consequences of that act." Humiliating the goddess. Almost all the female characters in Gilgamesh, Shamhat, Ninsun, Shiduri, and Utnapishtim's wife, are portrayed as admirable, intelligent, generous, compassionate. The one exception is Ishtar, goddess of love and patron deity of Uruk. In the very peculiar and invigorating Book 6, she is rejected, insulted, threatened, and humiliated by both Gilgamesh and Enkidu. This is surprising in a poem that mentions her temple with reverence and makes one of her priestesses a central character in the initial drama. It is even more surprising in light of the goddess's millennia-old position in Mesopotamian culture. She was known to the Sumerians as Inanna, the Queen of Heaven, and played a greater role in mythic, epic, and hymn than any other deity, male or female. Anyone who has first read the beautiful, tender, marvelously erotic song cycle called The Courtship of Inanna and Dumuzi is likely to feel flabbergasted at the shabby treatment Ishtar receives at the hand of the Gilgamesh poet. But there is another side to the beloved goddess who brought culture and fertility to her people in Sumer. She is also the goddess of war, and she can be selfish, arbitrary, and brutal. In the Sumerian poem, The Descent of Inanna, she fastens the eye of death on her husband Dumuzi, Tammuz, and orders him to be dragged down to hell by two persistent demons. In a lesser-known poem called Inanna and Ebi, which begins with an invocation to the goddess of the dreadful powers, clad in terror, drenched in blood, she destroys an entire mountain range because it doesn't show her enough respect. Sumerian literature furnishes other examples of her ruthlessness. Why the Gilgamesh poet chose to focus so exclusively on Ishtar's dark side in Book 6 and to portray his heroes as so vituperative is a mystery. No scholar has provided an adequate explanation of whatever cultural forces were at work behind the episode. Is it symptomatic of a religious movement among first the Sumerians and later the Babylonians to displace her with a male deity? Then why are her priestesses treated with such respect? And how can we explain the poet's irreverence to the gods in general, who are later compared to dogs and flies? We just don't know. All we can do is enjoy the episode and see how it fits into the poem as a whole. Things begin calmly enough. Gilgamesh, having returned from the cedar forest, washes himself and gets dressed in his magnificent royal robes. He is looking mighty fine. Ishtar sees him and falls in love, or lust. In a speech that seems forward or straightforward, depending on one's cultural bias, she propositions him, offering him an array of fabulous gifts, if only he will be her lover. Gilgamesh's rejection is at first polite, even tactful, but it soon changes into a series of metaphorical insults, all of which accuse Ishtar of damaging the very person whom she should have been caring for. Next, he cites 6 famous love affairs of Ishtar's, with Tammuz, then with the roller bird, the lion, the stallion, the shepherd, and the gardener Ishulanu. Her taste in lovers is species transcendent, omnisexual. All of them black widow affairs in which she turned against her lover and harmed him. Gilgamesh concludes by saying that if he were to accept her offer, she would treat him as cruelly as she treated them. It is a remarkably vivid speech, the longest in the poem, except for Utnapishtim's account of the flood. Reading it, we are caught up in the pure energy of the insults. It is like a tribal dance in which lines of young men and young women advance in turn and fling ritual taunts at each other. The speech's climax, the catalogue of lovers, is a miniature metamorphosis that casts Ishtar as Circe and moves from disaster to disaster, not only with the satisfaction of a lawyer proving his case, but also with the delight of a storyteller. Aside from the affair with Tammuz, we are ignorant of the myths the poet is referring to. They haven't survived in Sumerian or Akkadian literature. For modern readers, this gives the passage a certain piquancy, as if we were overhearing intimate stories about people we don't know. Is Gilgamesh's response inappropriate? Is it a frightened male reaction to a woman who takes the sexual initiative? Perhaps, though that would be odd in a poem that celebrates a character like Shamhat. But from the above-mentioned Descent of Inanna, we can be sure that in at least one of his 6 examples, Gilgamesh is giving us accurate information. Sleeping with Ishtar can be dangerous to your health, and when we witness her violent response to his rejection, we tend to think that he has been entirely reasonable in just saying no. The next scene is a portrait of Ishtar as a murderous, spoiled brat. She explodes with tears of rage and frustration, goes to Anu, father of the gods, and throws a tantrum until he lends her the bull of heaven to kill Gilgamesh and destroy his palace. As a woman scorned, Ishtar is not only petulant and vengeful, she is a real monster, willing to sacrifice hundreds of people for the sake of her revenge. But Enkidu and Gilgamesh make short work of the gigantic bull. They are fearless. There is none of the hauntedness and wavering of the Humbaba episode. There isn't even a feeling of danger, in spite of the bull's first 2 warrior-demolishing snorts. The action is swift, the humor coarse, and the killing of the bull seems less a battle than a sport. In its grace of movement, it is like the roughly contemporaneous bull-leaping fresco in the Palace of Knossos on Crete, in which an athlete has leaped over the bull's horns and, arms gripping its sides, legs dangling above his head, is about to flip over its haunch onto the ground. Ishtar is brought to helpless tears by her failure. Standing on top of the city wall, she cries out, "Not only did Gilgamesh slander me, now the brute has killed his own punishment, the bull of heaven." This is funny, but with an uncomfortable kind of humor that depends on the humiliation of the villain. How many of us nowadays can enjoy Shylock's anguished, ridiculous cry, "My daughter! Oh, my ducats! Oh, my daughter!" Even when the villainess has just murdered 300 people, one doesn't like to take pleasure in her pain. Enkidu, however, is not so delicate. When Enkidu heard these words, he laughed. He reached down, ripped off one of the bull's thighs, and flung it in Ishtar's face. "If only I could catch you, this is what I would do to you. I would rip you apart and drape the bull's guts over your arms." Here again, as in the killing of Humbaba, Enkidu is the more extreme of the 2 friends. As with the hero's ethic, Enkidu has gotten on Gilgamesh's high horse and ridden it so far that Gilgamesh seems almost temperate in comparison. This final heaping of insult upon insult, as energizing as it is shocking in its hubris and sheer outrageousness, is clearly dangerous, especially when your opponent is a goddess. What makes it so grotesquely funny is the combination of innocence and cruelty, in which there is more than a passing resemblance between Ishtar and the two heroes. Later that day, after the victory parade, when Gilgamesh boasts and does his victory strut, he reminds us of a champion athlete who not only crushes his opponent, but flips him the bird. "Tell me, who is the handsomest of men? Tell me, who is the bravest of heroes? Gilgamesh, he is the handsomest of men. Enkidu, he is the bravest of heroes. We are the victors who in our fury flung the bull's thigh in Ishtar's face, and now, in the streets, she has no one to avenge her." There are more intelligent ways to return home after a death that you know has enraged the great gods. If the psychological task of the hero is to gain mastery over the internal monsters by killing the external ones, Gilgamesh has been radically unsuccessful. Killing Humbaba and the bull has given him no greater control over himself and his own arrogance. Enkidu's arrival may have provided some balance for him, at least he has stopped oppressing the citizens of Uruk. But if the gods expected that Enkidu would provide peace for the king as well as for the city, they are sadly mistaken. Gilgamesh will have to learn limits another way. It is obvious that Book 6 is a separable episode that could be omitted without any loss of continuity. The heroes kill Humbaba in Book 5, and in the death of Enkidu at the end of Book 7, they suffer the results of their act. But the progression to tragedy would seem abrupt without the Ishtar episode. Book 6 is a comic interlude, like the satyr play that was performed after Greek tragedies. Obscene, vulgar, high-spirited, irreverent, and rambunctious, letting loose all the energies that will soon enough become contained and very somber. Death and Departure. Suddenly Enkidu has two dreams about dying. The second of them gives us a wonderfully graphic picture of how the ancient Mesopotamians imagined the dead, who sit miserably in pitch darkness, dressed in feathered garments like birds. The great gods are not mocked, and the killing of Humbaba will have fatal consequences. Gilgamesh, through his tears, calls the first dream nonsense, and makes a weak attempt to interpret the second one as a good omen. But both friends know that Enkidu is doomed, and indeed, as his dreams warned, he falls mortally ill. The next morning, Enkidu curses the trapper, and then Shamhat, for taking him out of the wilderness. It never occurs to him to curse his beloved Gilgamesh as well, though this was Gilgamesh's idea. The speech expresses Enkidu's impotence at the thought of dying, and part of its power is in letting out all the stops on the vindictive, outward-blaming ego. "May wild dogs camp in your bedroom," Enkidu says. "May owls nest in your attic. May drunkards vomit all over you. May a tavern wall be your place of business. May you be dressed in torn robes and filthy underwear. May angry wives sue you. May thorns and briars make your feet bloody. May young men jeer and the rabble mock you as you walk the streets." The speech is not just a rant. It is also powerful reporting, once we transpose the optative to the indicative. A portrait of the life of an aging prostitute, with its poverty, abuse, and humiliation. Shamash provides Enkidu with a more balanced view that calms his raging heart. Civilization, the god points out, has been just as much a paradise for Enkidu as the wilderness was. And wasn't it Shamhat who brought Enkidu the greatest joy of all, his friendship with Gilgamesh? Enkidu acknowledges this and turns his curse of Shamhat into a blessing. "May you be adored by nobles and princes," he says. "May Ishtar give you generous lovers whose treasure chests brim with jewels and gold." In the interval between the curse and the blessing, Shamhat has ascended from the cheapest of whores to the most expensive and esteemed of courtesans, a kind of Babylonian Ninon de l'Enclos. Oddly, both curse and blessing imagine Shamhat as a prostitute, poor or rich, rather than a priestess. Enkidu doesn't seem to know the difference. Of course, it is possible that many priestesses of Ishtar would have been delighted to be wealthy courtesans instead, but for the true devotee, the change would hardly have been a blessing. Devotion to the goddess was at the core of her life, and in comparison, even the kind of wealth and adulation given to a Hollywood star would be meaningless. After 12 days of agony, Enkidu dies and leaves Gilgamesh alone with his grief. It is a tragic moment in the epic, though epics are not necessarily tragic. The Homeric poems contain both the tragedy of Achilles and the romance of Odysseus, with its happy ending, for him, if not for the suitors and the little dangling maids. Enkidu could easily be seen as a tragic hero, pulled out of his Eden into the corrupt world of humans to suffer an arbitrary death sentence from the gods. And, as reconciled as he seems, there is a certain lingering bitterness about his death. One might say that his death was caused by Gilgamesh's monster hunting, just as his birth was caused by Gilgamesh's tyranny. But more accurately, Enkidu caused his own death by insisting that Gilgamesh kill Humbaba. If they had let the monster live, all would have been well. The fact that neither Enkidu nor Gilgamesh ever realizes this is part of the pathos of the situation. Gilgamesh's lament at the beginning of Book 8 is one of the most beautiful elegies in literature. In it, he asks both the natural world and the world of the city to join him as he mourns his friend. The simple, repeated phrases of his lament are exquisitely sorrowful. "My beloved friend is dead. He is dead. My beloved brother is dead. I will mourn as long as I breathe. I will sob for him like a woman who has lost her only child." Gilgamesh's grief is too intense for any understanding to penetrate. There is no way, in spite of Enkidu's first dream, that he can make a casual connection between the killing of Humbaba and Enkidu's death. For him, the events just occurred, one after the other. And he can still boast of the killings, unconscious that they have cost him his beloved friend. Indeed, the music of his grief is so enchanting that, for the time being, we don't even want him to understand. "Beloved friend, swift stallion, wild deer, leopard ranging in the wilderness, Enkidu, my friend, swift stallion, wild deer, leopard ranging in the wilderness. Together we crossed the mountains, together we slaughtered the bull of heaven, we killed Humbaba, who guarded the cedar forest." Actually, he is in a trance of pain. Even if he could understand why Enkidu died, it wouldn't matter. The brute fact of the event would blot out any other consideration. He is so overwhelmed by the sight of Enkidu's lifeless body that, a dozen lines after lamenting that his friend is dead, he can no longer even find a name for death. As a great warrior, he has seen and caused many deaths, but now, for the first time, death is an intimate reality, and he can barely recognize it. "Oh, Enkidu, what is this sleep that has seized you, that has darkened your face and stopped your breath?" Even though he has been up all night, sobbing for Enkidu, he can't let himself know what has happened. It's as if he has never seen a corpse before. He reacts like a young child, or like an animal sniffing at the dead body of its mate, bewildered. He half expects Enkidu to answer. When he touches Enkidu's heart, he seems surprised that it isn't beating. It takes a while longer for Gilgamesh to finally acknowledge that his friend is dead. But even then, his first gesture is to make death into a kind of marriage. He can't help treating Enkidu as if he were still alive and in mortal danger. After being the desolate bridegroom, he becomes the anxious mother. Then he veiled Enkidu's face like a bride's. Like an eagle Gilgamesh circled around him, he paced in front of him back and forth, like a lioness whose cubs are trapped in a pit. He tore out clumps of his hair, tore off his magnificent robes as though they were cursed. Finally, it's over. Gilgamesh orders a magnificent votive statue of Enkidu. He goes through all the necessary rituals to ensure that the gods of the underworld will welcome him and help him to be peaceful and not sick at heart. But the ritual gestures, though meticulous, seem desperate. At best, Enkidu will be one of those miserable, dirt-eating human birds who squat or shuffle in utter darkness forever. This is poor comfort. So, abandoning all his privileges and responsibilities, giving up his roles as warrior and king, reversing Enkidu's journey from wilderness to civilization, Gilgamesh puts on an animal skin and leaves Uruk. His departure is reminiscent of another royal departure 1,000 years later, of the Buddha. Like Gilgamesh, Gautama, the future awakened one, is transfixed by a vision of human vulnerability and feels compelled to leave his palace and all his possessions behind, so that he can search for the secret of life and death. Gautama's grief is not personal, though. He hasn't lost a beloved friend. He hasn't lost anyone except himself, his own identity. When, for the first time in his sheltered life, he sees sickness, old age, and death, his whole idea of what it is to be human, what it is that someday awaits him, collapses, and he is plunged into a desperate questioning. His story has a happier ending than Gilgamesh's. After 6 years of futile austerities, he sits down under the Bodhi tree, determined not to move until either death or understanding comes. And at dawn, when the morning star appears, suddenly he wakes up from the dream of suffering. "When you see the unborn, uncreated, unconditioned," he later said, "you are liberated from everything born, created, and conditioned." Gilgamesh, too, asks an all-consuming question about life and death. But his question is not driven by a deep need for understanding. It is driven by fear. Rilke called Gilgamesh the epic of the fear of death. Fear is the reverse side of the cool warrior ethos, in which the consciousness of mortality motivates the hero to establish his fame. "Our days are few in number," Gilgamesh had said imperturbably. "Why be afraid, then, since sooner or later death must come?" Why, indeed? Except that terror comes unbidden, on the way to monsters, or in the presence of overwhelming loss. Love has changed everything. It has made Gilgamesh absolutely vulnerable. His earlier consciousness of mortality turns out to be a pale, abstract thing in comparison with the anguish he feels as he roams through the wilderness. "Must I die, too? Must I be as lifeless as Enkidu? How can I bear this sorrow that gnaws at my belly, this fear of death that restlessly drives me onward? If only I could find the one man whom the gods made immortal, I would ask him How to Overcome Death. In his previous heroic mode, Gilgamesh thought he knew that only the gods live forever. Now, terrified, he is no longer certain. His first question, "Must I die too?" is not rhetorical. He really doesn't know the answer anymore. It is the question of a child at the threshold of adult awareness, who for the first time is faced with the concept of dying. Every child, to become an adult, must realize that the answer to that question is yes. Once he has passed through the gate of "I will die," he can later, if his questioning goes deep enough, pass through the gate of "I was never born." Gilgamesh wants to find the one exception to the rule of mortality, his ancestor Utnapishtim, who was granted eternal life and dwells somewhere at the eastern edge of the world. The fact that there has been one exception to the rule of mortality means that there might be a second exception. This hope postpones Gilgamesh's necessary acceptance until a time when he is more ready for it, less raw with grief. Like a thousand later heroes in folk tales and Zen stories, he sets out in search of a teacher who can give him wisdom. In this, he is bound to be disappointed. Wisdom isn't an object. It can't be grasped by words, nor can it be passed on. But until Gilgamesh completes his quest, he won't be able to realize the futility of it. "This thing we tell of can never be found by seeking," said the Sufi master Abu Yazid al-Bastami. "Yet only seekers find it." The first arrival we hear about is at the Twin Peaks, two high mountains overlooking the tunnel into which the sun sets for its nightly underground journey, and out of which it rises in the morning. Two terrifying monsters, called Scorpion People, guard the eastern end of this tunnel, just as Humbaba guarded the cedar forest. After Gilgamesh recovers from his dread and approaches them, he is no longer in a monster-slaying frame of mind, the creatures turn out to be quite courteous and tell him that the road to Utnapishtim lies through the tunnel. The Scorpion Man, at his wife's compassionate urging, allows Gilgamesh to enter the tunnel, warning him that if he fails to get to the western end before the sun enters, he will be burned to a crisp. For 12 hours, non-stop, Gilgamesh runs through the pitch blackness, and he exits just as the sun is setting. This is a symbolic death and rebirth in which he passes through the darkness of an underworld and emerges into the dazzling, Arabian Nights-like garden of the gods. But in its effects, it is not much of a rebirth. Gilgamesh is the same anguished, violent man he was before. Indeed, when he meets Shiduri, the tavern keeper, he looks so murderous that she runs into her tavern and locks herself in. Gilgamesh deals with this by threatening to smash down the door. Force is still his automatic reaction, the way he responds to the world. Shiduri is a strange character, a matron, possibly a goddess, who brews beer in a tavern at the edge of the ocean, apparently for those rare customers who can outrace the sun. She is frightened, but curious, and from the roof asks Gilgamesh questions about his appearance and his destination that are repeated later in the poem. Gilgamesh once again gives eloquent voice to his grief. "Shouldn't my heart be filled with anguish?" he cries out. "My friend, my brother, whom I loved so dearly, who accompanied me through every danger, Enkidu, my brother, whom I loved so dearly, who accompanied me through every danger, the fate of mankind has overwhelmed him. For 6 days I would not let him be buried, thinking, if my grief is violent enough, perhaps he will come back to life again. For 6 days and 7 nights I mourned him, until a maggot fell out of his nose. Then I was afraid. I was frightened by death, and I set out to roam the wilderness. I cannot bear what happened to my friend. I cannot bear what happened to Enkidu. So I roam the wilderness in my grief. How can my mind have any rest? My beloved friend has turned into clay. My beloved Enkidu has turned into clay. And won't I too lie down in the dirt like him and never arise again? This speech is as palpable and moving as his lament in Book 8. Shidori sends him on to the next stage of his journey, but not before giving him a charming piece of conventional wisdom that can do him no earthly good. No advice can. He needs to come to wisdom by himself. Savor your food. Make each of your days a delight. Bathe and anoint yourself. Wear bright clothes that are sparkling clean. Let music and dancing fill your house. Love the child who holds you by the hand, and give your wife pleasure in your embrace. That is the best way for a man to live. But Gilgamesh is incapable of enjoyment. He must persevere until he finds Utnapishtim. Shidori tells him that the only man who can help is Ushanabi, Utnapishtim's boatman. If Gilgamesh asks, perhaps Ushanabi will sail him across the vast ocean in his boat, crewed by the stone men who are invulnerable to the waters of death. Instead of being civil to the man on whom everything now depends, Gilgamesh proceeds with the senseless, self-defeating violence he is used to. He attacks Ushanabi and smashes the stone men to pieces. Fortunately for him, however, Ushanabi is a genial, forgiving fellow who proposes an alternative method of crossing the waters of death using punting poles instead of the demolished stone men. They sail, without stopping, for 3 days and nights, a 6 weeks' journey for ordinary men, cross the waters of death, and finally land on the shore where Utnapishtim is waiting. Gilgamesh doesn't realize it yet, but he is standing face to face with the man who is his last hope. When there's no way out, you just follow the way in front of you. The archetypal hero's journey proceeds in stages, being called to action, meeting a wise man or guide, crossing the threshold into the numinous world of the adventure, passing various tests, attaining the goal, defeating the forces of evil, and going back home. It leads to a spiritual transformation at the end, a sense of gratitude, humility, and deepened trust in the intelligence of the universe. After he finds the treasure, or slays the dragon, or wins the princess, or joins with the mind of the sage, the hero can return to ordinary life in a state of grace, as a blessing to himself and to his whole community. He has suffered, he has triumphed, he is at peace. The more we try to fit Gilgamesh into the pattern of this archetypal journey, the more bizarre, quirky, and postmodern it seems. It is the original quest story, but it is also an anti-quest since it undermines the quest myth from the beginning. Gilgamesh does slay the monster, but that, it turns out, is a violation of the divine order of things and causes the death of his beloved friend. He does journey to the edge of the world, he meets the wise man, but still there is no transformation. Utnapishtim asks him the same questions Shidori asked, and Gilgamesh answers with the same anguished cries, whereupon Utnapishtim offers him yet another piece of conventional wisdom, beautiful words, but as useless to him as Shidori's were. What's the good of saying, like everybody's obtuse uncle, that Gilgamesh should realize how fortunate he is, that life is short and death is final? It is like all well-meaning advice that tells us to accept things as they are. We can't accept things as they are, so long as we think that things should be different. Tell us how not to believe what we think, and then maybe we'll be able to hear. In any case, for Utnapishtim to say that life is short is a bit disingenuous. Life isn't short for him. That's the point. Why else has Gilgamesh traveled to the edge of the world to see him? The desperate, grief-stricken man standing before Utnapishtim feels less fortunate than the very fool he is purportedly so superior to. He wants to transcend death, not accept it. Right now, not in some happy future. There is no consolation in platitudes, and for Utnapishtim to tell him that he is going to die seems as tactless as it was for St. Paul to tell the Thessalonians that they were not going to die. The only effect the speech seems to have is that Gilgamesh finally recognizes the old man as Utnapishtim. He also acts with a restraint that we haven't seen before. "I intended to fight you," he says. "Yet now that I stand before you, now that I see who you are, I can't fight. Something is holding me back." Finally, Gilgamesh gets to ask his burning question. How did Utnapishtim overcome death and become immortal? Utnapishtim, who is not a believer in making a long story short, tells him about the great flood. His speech is a very strong piece of writing, as beautiful as its descendant, the Noah story, but far more detailed and dramatic, and filled with the most vivid images. The unsuspecting workmen drinking barrels of beer and wine to celebrate the completion of the ship. The terrified gods fleeing to the highest heaven and cowering there like dogs. Utnapishtim falling to his knees and weeping at the first touch of the blessed sunlight. The gods, starved because all their human food providers have drowned, smelling the sweet fragrance of Utnapishtim's sacrifice and clustering around it like flies. The flood story explains Utnapishtim's exemption from mortality by narrating the circumstances that prompted the god's decision. It also explains the prologue statement that Gilgamesh had been granted a vision into the great mystery, the secret places, the primeval days before the flood. The vision into the great mystery does not, however, seem to do Gilgamesh a bit of good, at least now. It certainly doesn't tell him how to overcome death. Immortality, it turns out, was a one-time offer. And that bleak fact is Utnapishtim's main revelation. Why, then, did the poet include the flood story at such length? Is it merely an interesting digression? Any reader who wants to understand its dramatic function in the poem should read Book 11 again, this time skipping from Gilgamesh's first question, "Tell me, how is it that you, a mortal..." to the end of Utnapishtim's speech, "Now then, Gilgamesh, who will assemble?" If you delete or drastically abridge the flood story, the interval between the question and the dashing of Gilgamesh's hopes seems far too short. But with the story continuing for as long as it does, the suspense keeps growing. We are aware that Gilgamesh is listening with absolute attention, because at any moment the way to overcome death might be revealed. We can feel his attention even the second or tenth time we read this speech, when we know that Gilgamesh won't find his answer. And when the speech comes to its disappointing climax, we are carried on to the next incident with at least the satisfaction of knowing the whole story. We have heard everything there is to hear about how Utnapishtim became a god. Obviously, this is not the way out. The story has another dramatic effect as well. It gives us a harrowing picture of the cost of Utnapishtim's immortality. The immortality itself seems like a pallid afterthought. Hovering in the background of this narrative is an unspoken question. If you had to experience all that terror and the death of almost every living thing in order to be granted immortality, Would it seem worth it? Far from being sympathetic to Gilgamesh's anguish, Utnapishtim is gruff, almost taunting, in the conclusion to his speech. "Now then, Gilgamesh, who will assemble the gods for your sake? Who will convince them to grant you the eternal life that you seek?" The more Utnapishtim reveals of his crankiness and cynicism, the less attractive immortality becomes. He proposes a test. If Gilgamesh can overcome sleep for 7 days, sleep being the likeness of death, perhaps he will be able to overcome death too. But Utnapishtim knows from the start that Gilgamesh, worn out and ready to collapse, will fail the test. And indeed, he falls asleep immediately. Utnapishtim says with contempt, "Look at this fellow. He wanted to live forever, but the very moment he sat down, sleep swirled over him like a fog." There is a poignant irony about this test. In the bad old days, when Gilgamesh was terrorizing the citizens of Uruk, it was a well-known fact, as Shamhat told Enkidu, that the king was so full of life force that he needed no sleep. Sometime after Enkidu's arrival, he lost that vitality, in the same way that Enkidu, after he made love with Shamhat, lost his life force and could no longer run like an animal. In this, too, Gilgamesh and Enkidu are twins. The poem doesn't tell us exactly when Gilgamesh began to need sleep. The first we hear of it is on the journey to the cedar forest, when it is a recurring element in the ritual for dreams. Gilgamesh sat there with his chin on his knees, and sleep overcame him as it does all men. Experiencing intimacy seems to be for Gilgamesh what experiencing sex is for Enkidu, an initiation into human vulnerability. Once he found the companion of his heart, Gilgamesh became, in effect, three-thirds human. He left behind his kinship with the unsleeping, undying gods, just as Enkidu left behind the two-thirds of him that was animal. Unwittingly, each gave up part of his physical strength in order to know the kind of love that an animal or a god can't know. After Gilgamesh fails the test, Utnapishtim's wife, sweet where her husband is sour, suggests that they wake him up and gently send him back home. But according to Utnapishtim, Gilgamesh is a deceiver, like all humans, and must be shown proof that he slept, and this the 7 hardening loaves provide. Gilgamesh, acknowledging his failure, cries out in a very moving and beautiful passage, "What shall I do? Where shall I go now? Death has caught me. It lurks in my bedroom, and everywhere I look. Everywhere I turn, there is only death." After first making sure that Gilgamesh is washed and anointed in a kind of ritual renewal, and is given royal robes that will stay clean until he returns to Uruk, Utnapishtim sends him on his way. And that seems to be the end of the story. But Utnapishtim's compassionate wife intervenes once again. So, as a parting gift, Utnapishtim reveals a second secret of the gods. He tells Gilgamesh where, in the waters of the great deep, the freshwater sea under the earth, he can find a magical plant that will restore him to youth. However young his name implies he is, Gilgamesh feels old and weary now, and in desperate need of renewal. He plunges into the great deep, finds the plant, and brings it to the surface. Finally, it seems, he has found something that will put his heart at ease. But in this poem, there is always a but. Gilgamesh's speech to Ur-Shanabi the boatman on the shore of the great deep is a wonderfully complex little passage. First, he calls the marvelous plant the antidote to the fear of death. And our questions begin. if eating the plant is not equivalent to passing the sleep test, but is a consolation prize instead, if it doesn't make you immortal like the fruit of the tree of life in the Garden of Eden, does it at least restore you to a protected youth in which you can't get fatally sick or injured, after which you again age and then die? Or is your youth just as vulnerable as an ordinary young person's? And when you grow old, can you take another bite and grow young a second time, a 100th time, until the supply gives out? None of this is made clear. None of it has to be. Any of it is possible. What is clear is that for someone who eats the plant, death has been temporarily avoided, and the fear of death has been postponed. The plant is a medicine that addresses the symptoms of the fear of death, not its cause. It is a palliative, not a cure. Still, Gilgamesh is elated. He tells Ur-Shanabi that rather than eating the plant immediately, he first wants to test its effects. "I will take it to Uruk. I will test its power by seeing what happens when an old man eats it. If that succeeds, I will eat some myself and become a carefree young man again." This statement, too, is complex and fascinating. Like the killing of Humbaba, it is first of all story-driven rather than character-driven. Gilgamesh must kill the monster because that's what heroes do. He must not eat the plant because, as we all know, he returns home aged and exhausted. But there are several possibilities implicit in his desire to take the plant home. Perhaps he is just being prudent for the first time in his life. Perhaps he is afraid of the plant's effects, or at least cautious about them, and needs to use an old man in Uruk as a human guinea pig. On the other hand, it may not be prudence that motivates him to bring the plant home before eating it. Perhaps some transformation in his character has already begun, which makes him want to postpone the magical return to youth until he can do it in his own city, before the eyes of his own people. Perhaps there is also a desire to use the plant for the benefit of the whole community. He will go home, choose a particularly deserving old man who has nothing to lose by having the experiment fail, and if it succeeds, he will portion out tiny samples of the plant to 1,000 old men and give a sprig to the royal gardener to see if it can be cultivated in lush-gardened Uruk, so that it will be available for future generations as well. It is possible that something like these thoughts are taking shape in the shadowy recesses of Gilgamesh's mind. So, without tasting the plant, he and Ur-Shanabi head back to Uruk. The poet describes the trip in the same words that he used for the journey to the cedar forest. At 400 miles they stopped to eat, at 1,000 miles they pitched their camp. This is a reverse journey through the landscape of dreams. It is, in its formulaic language, the way back from the monster. But this time, it is not a return to hubris, violence, and death. It is a return to wholeness. Still, there is one last failure to endure and overcome. On the way back, Gilgamesh bathes in a pond, and rather than handing the precious plant to Ur-Shanabi, he leaves it on the ground. This act of stunning carelessness is like other famous last-minute mistakes in myths and folktales throughout the world. Orpheus's over-the-shoulder glance at Eurydice, for example, or the youngest son's choice to sit on the edge of a well in the Grimm's The Golden Bird. There is always something fated about these mistakes. They don't seem like accidents, because they are willed by the shape of the story. We feel that they had to happen. In light of Gilgamesh's history of violence and self-destruction, it seems that some inner dynamic won't allow him to eat the plant. That would be too simple, too good to be true. The spoiler is a snake, as in the Eden story, though here the snake is not cunning, it is entirely innocent, and simply takes advantage of a good opportunity. The poet needs only three lines to shatter Gilgamesh's hopes. A snake smelled its fragrance, stealthily it crawled up, and carried the plant away. As it disappeared, it cast off its skin. Thus, in the words of Psalm 103, the snake's mouth is satisfied with good things, and its youth is renewed like the eagle's. O Felix Serpens! When Gilgamesh realizes that the snake has slithered off with his antidote, he cries out yet again, "What shall I do now? All my hardships have been for nothing. Oh, Ur-Shanabi, was it for this that my hands have labored? Was it for this that I gave my heart's blood?" It is the last gasp of tragedy. One is touched by his anguish, but only so far. One also wants to say, "Well, what do you expect, you silly goose? That's what happens when you leave magic plants lying on the ground." This is not the point, of course. The episode is not meant to be a lesson in prudence. It is the end of the line for Gilgamesh's quest. He is face to face with the realization that there is no immortality and no return to youth. A realization that can result, depending on your readiness, in either despair or freedom. When there's no way out, you just follow the way in front of you. That way, for Gilgamesh, leads back home. And on the way home, in the course of the hundreds of miles, he and Ur-Shanabi travel every day, in the dream time that is left in total silence, an astonishing thing happens. Gilgamesh becomes one with the poet's voice. In spite of the prologue's statement, we have never believed that Gilgamesh wrote the poem. He has always been a character in the story, not the narrator of it, a part of it, not the whole. Only now, for the first time, as Gilgamesh addresses Ur-Shanabi with the same words that Sinleika Unini addressed us with at the beginning of the poem, can we hear this authorial voice for ourselves. When at last they arrived, Gilgamesh said to Ur-Shanabi, "This is the wall of Uruk, which no city on earth can equal. See how its ramparts gleam like copper in the sun. Climb the stone staircase, more ancient than the mind can imagine. Approach the Eanna temple, sacred to Ishtar, a temple that no king has equaled in size or beauty. Walk on the wall of Uruk, follow its course around the city, inspect its mighty foundations, examine its brickwork, how masterfully it is built. Observe the land it encloses, the palm trees, the gardens, the orchards, the glorious palaces and temples, the shops and marketplaces, the houses, the public squares." And that is how the poem ends, where it began. Its form is not circular like Finnegan's Wake, but spiral, since it begins again at another level, with Gilgamesh narrating. His transformation has taken place offstage, outside the frame of the poem, at the last possible moment. When we return to the beginning, where Gilgamesh's echoing lines point us, it is clear that he has completed the final stage of the archetypal hero's journey, in which the hero gives new life to his community, returning to them with the gifts he has discovered on his adventure. He brought back the ancient, forgotten rites, restoring the temples that the flood had destroyed, renewing the statutes and sacraments for the welfare of the people and the sacred land. We are not told how he learned the ancient forgotten rites from Utnapishtim, but we know that for the first time he is acting as a responsible, compassionate king, a benefactor to his people and their descendants. Out of the depths, somehow, Gilgamesh has managed to close the gate of sorrow. He has learned how to rule himself and his city without violence, selfishness, or the compulsions of a restless heart. Gilgamesh's quest is not an allegory. It is too subtle and rich in minute particulars to fit any abstract scheme. But issuing as it does from a deep level of human experience, it has a certain allegorical resonance. We don't need to be aware of this resonance in order to enjoy the story, yet it is there. When Gilgamesh leaves his city and goes into uncharted territory in search of a way beyond death, he is looking for something that is impossible to find. His quest is like the mind's search for control, order, and meaning in a world where everything is constantly disintegrating. The quest proves the futility of the quest. There is no way to overcome death. There is no way to control reality. When I argue with reality, I lose, Byron Katie writes, but only 100% of the time. Not until Gilgamesh gives up on transcendence can he realize how beautiful his city is. Only then, freed from his restless heart, can he fully return to the place he started out from. Suppose that the city is this moment, things as they are, without any meaning added. When the mind gives up on its quest for control, order, and meaning, it finds that it has come home to reality, where it has always been. What it has, what it is, in this very moment, is everything it ever wanted. Somehow, in the interval between story and return, Gilgamesh has become wise. He has absorbed not the conventional wisdom of a Shiduri or an Utnapishtim, but the deeper wisdom of the poem's narrative voice, a wisdom that is impartial, humorous, civilized, sexual, irreverent, skeptical of moral absolutes, delighted with the things of this world, and supremely confident in the power of its own language. About this version. I have called this a version of Gilgamesh rather than a translation. I don't read cuneiform and have no knowledge of Akkadian. For the meaning of the text, I have depended on literal translations by 7 scholars. I am particularly indebted to A.R. George's superb, meticulous, monumental 2-volume edition of the original texts, which far excels all previous scholarship. I have also read and profited from the translations of Jean Bontereau, Benjamin R. Foster, Marine Gallery Kovach, Albert Schott, and Raymond Jacques Tournay and Aaron Schaffer, as well as from the literary, non-scholarly versions of David Ferry and Raoul Schrott. Jean Bontereau's notes helped me in the interpretation of many passages. My method was this. I first read and compared all the translations listed in the bibliography, unraveled the difficult passages to the best of my inexpert ability, and cobbled together a rough prose version. Like many other translators, I have omitted Tablet 12, which most scholars consider as not belonging to the epic. At this stage, I felt rather like a bat, feeling out the contours of the original text by flinging sound waves into the dark. Once my prose version was completed, I began the real work of raising the language to the level of English verse. The line that I use, a loose, non-iambic, non-alliterative tetrameter, is rare in English. The 2 examples I know well are sections of Eliot's 4 quartets and Elizabeth Bishop's wonderful Sestina. I worked hard to keep my rhythms from sounding too regular, and I varied them so that no 2 consecutive lines have the identical rhythm. When possible, I kept fairly close to the literal meaning. When necessary, I was much freer and did not so much translate as adapt. I chose not to reproduce some of the quirks of Akkadian style, which for ancient readers may have been embellishments, but are tedious for us. For example, the word-for-word repetitions of entire passages and the enumerations from 1 to 7 or 12. I filled in the many gaps in the text. I changed images that were unclear. I added lines when the drama of the situation called for elaboration, or when passages ended abruptly and needed transitions. I cut out a number of fragmentary passages, and when the text was garbled, I occasionally changed the order of passages. All these changes are documented in the notes. While I have tried to be faithful to the spirit of the Akkadian text, I have often been as free with the letter of it as Sinleika Unini and his old Babylonian predecessors were with their material. I like to think that they would have approved.
This ends author Stephen Mitchell's comprehensive essay on the creation of this version of Gilgamesh, read by John McDonough. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.